listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
He's been the target of an ongoing U.S. regime change operation since former U.S. President Barack Obama's May 2011 executive order, which continued in effect despite the fact that the national referendum in February of 2012 overwhelmingly approved the new constitution, one which his government had helped draft. And it continued after he was overwhelmingly elected president of the Syrian Arab Republic in the first presidential elections under that new constitution, in June of 2014. In that election, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad won 10,319,723 votes, representing 88.7% of all eligible voters and more than half of all living Syrian men, women, and children living anywhere in the world. Nevertheless, former President Obama, both of his secretaries of state, and the last past U.S. ambassadors to the U.N. under both the Obama and Trump administrations have repeatedly characterized Assad's presidency as illegitimate, a characterization, by the way, they have not used in describing, among other governments, that of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The ongoing war in Syria has been a creature of U.S. foreign policy since its inception in 2011, and yet the U.S. media, for some reason, has consistently portrayed it as an indigenous uprising against an illegitimate dictator. It's rare that Assad's words are even reported, and rarer still do we see the face-to-face interviews that would allow Americans to understand what their government is up to in Syria. This past week, RT's Murad Gazdiev sat down with President Bashar al-Assad of the Syrian Arab Republic in the capital of Damascus, and we bring you that interview in its entirety here with our thanks to RT and Murad Gazdiev.
Mr. President, since time is short, first question, your latest victories in Ghouta, in Yarmouk, they have drastically changed the situation on the ground in Syria. How much nearer the end of this war are we now, in your estimation?
First of all, you're most welcome in Syria. With every move forward in the battlefield, with every victory, with every liberated area, we are moving closer to the end of the conflict. And I always said, without external interference, it won't take more than a year to settle the situation in Syria. But at the same time, with every move forward for the Syrian army and for the political process and for the whole situation forward in the positive meaning towards the more stability, our enemies and our opponents, mainly the West, led by the United States and their puppets in Europe and in our region, with their mercenaries in Syria, they try to make it farther, either by supporting more terrorism, bringing more terrorists coming to Syria, or by hindering the political process. So our challenge is, how can we make this gap, to close this gap between their plans and our plans? And I think we are succeeding in that regard, but at the same time, it's difficult for anyone to tell you when, but it is getting closer, that's self-evident.
Well, your latest military victories, they have been, objectively speaking, spectacular. The speed at which rebel defenses that have withstood for years have collapsed. Are you planning on retaking all of Syria by force? We're talking about Idlib, the border with Israel, SDF-controlled territories.
The war is the worst choice. I think every Syrian agreed upon this fact. But sometimes you only have this choice, especially when you talk about factions like Al-Qaeda, like ISIS, like Al-Nusra, and the like-minded factions. Actually, most of them have the same ideology, Jaish Islam, Dahrar Sham, and so on. They're not ready for any dialogue. They don't have any political plan. They only have this dark ideological plan, is to be like any Al-Qaeda-controlled area anywhere in this world. So the only option to deal with those factions is force. At the same time, in other areas, we succeeded by implementing reconciliations, especially when the community in those different areas made pressure on those militants to leave those areas. So I think the best choice is to make reconciliation. This is our plan. But when it doesn't work, the only method to resort to is the force.
Well, with regards to reconciliation, how wise is it to send all of these veteran jihadists with their small arms to Idlib? By now, tens of thousands have gone to Idlib. They have consolidated. They have built defenses. Eventually, as you say, you'll have to fight them. On the other hand, are you perhaps planning on building an area that is outside of government control?
Actually, we always say we're going to liberate every area. So it's impossible for us to intentionally leave any area on the Syrian soil outside our control as government. This is natural. And as you know, Idlib was captured by the terrorists in 2015 with this Turkish support. It was mainly captured by Al-Nusra and some other supportive factions. We started the reconciliations before that time, but every reconciliation happened after that time, after 2015. It was, I think, May 2015. Every faction wanted to leave the city or the village. They choose to go to Idlib. This is a very good indication that they have the same ideology, because they choose to go to Al-Nusra area. They didn't choose to go to any other area. So we didn't send people to Idlib. They wanted to go to Idlib because they have the same incubator. They have the same atmosphere, way of thinking, and so on. This one part, the other part, which is military aspect of your question, the plan of the terrorists and their masters was to distract the Syrian army by scattering the different units all over the Syrian soil, which is not good for any army. Our plan was to put them in one area, two area, three areas. If you have two or three or four frontiers, better than having tens and maybe more than 100 frontiers at the same time. So militarily, it is better. They chose it, but it's better for us from the military point of view.
On the other hand, talking about similar mindsets, Idlib is predominantly the rebels there, overwhelmingly are Sunni. You know, as a Sunni myself, I have a long distant relative who came to Syria to fight against you, to resist you, because he was told that you were targeting, you were killing Sunnis, and that is what many people in Idlib believe. Why is it that so many people in all these different countries, in America, in Russia, these Sunnis, these Muslims, they believe that you are oppressing them?
Because the first narrative, when it started internationally, mainly in the West, of course, and within Syria, and in some mainstream medias in our region and in the West, their plan was to create this rift within the society that will make things easier for them when you have such a civil war, kind of civil war between sects or ethnicities, and it failed. Now they keep using the same narrative, at least to encourage some fanatics in different places in the world to come and defend their brothers in this area, because that's how they imagine. They imagine that there's conflict between sects. So because of their narrow-minded way of thinking, maybe of their ignorance, they came here just to support their brothers. Now, if I'm going to tell you this is right or wrong, your audience doesn't know me. They don't have any idea maybe about my credibility. But I'll tell you, you know Syria very well. It's better to go and see the reality on the ground. Now, if there's such a narrative, let's say, in reality, sect killing another sect, Syria should be divided now according to sectarian line. You should come to this area under our control and see one color or a few colors of the Syrian society. You should go to the other area where you have the terrorists. You should have different colors. And the reality is not like this. Now, in Damascus, in Aleppo, in Homs, in every area under the Syrian the Syrian government control, you will see every spectrum of the Syrian society, with no exceptions. So that this reality will debunk this narrative. I mean, how could they live with each other while the government is killing them according to sectarian basis? It doesn't work.
Fair enough. But with regards to negotiations and reconciliation, there have been efforts to start talks to achieve a result in Geneva, in Astana. There has been limited success, but it hasn't been all that great. Now, let's be honest, you're winning. You're winning on the ground, your forces are advancing, the rebels are in retreat. Why would you negotiate with them now that they're losing?
Since the very beginning, we said, whenever we can save Syrian blood, we have to go forward and deal with this, with any initiative, any kind of initiative, even if they have bad will. Some initiative have bad will, but in spite of that, we dealt with. And the reality now, if you go around Syria, the reality, the results that's been embodied by the reconciliations is a proof of what I'm saying. Without this policy, without this intention of saving blood, negotiating, talking to people, we couldn't have reached this reconciliations. This is one thing. The other thing, not everyone for the government have the same basis. Some of them have ideological background, some of them poor financial background. Some of them, they made mistake at the very beginning, they were forced to go in that direction and they couldn't with the door. So you have to open the doors and you have to distinguish between different kind of people. And the most important than this, the majority of the people who were against the government apparently in the different liberated area, actually in their hearts, they are with the government. Because they could tell the difference between having government and having chaos.
Well, with regards to talks and, you know, retaking areas by force. Let's take, for example, SDF-controlled territories in Deir ez-Zor. There have been clashes there between troops who were loyal to you and the SDF itself, United States partners. And the United States brought to bear force to stop troops loyal to you from taking territories. This has happened at Al-Tanf as well. How are you going to deal with the United States presence, military presence in Syria?
After the liberation of Aleppo and later Deir ez-Zor, and before that Homs and now Damascus, actually the United States is losing its cards. The main card was al-Nusra, that was called moderate. But when the scandal started leaking that they are not moderate, they are al-Qaeda, that was supposed to be fought by United States, they look for another card. This card is the SDF now, because when, as it seems, as you just mentioned, we are moving forward in the different areas to defeat the terrorists, the only problem left in Syria is the SDF. We're going to deal with it by two options. The first one, we started now opening doors for negotiations, because the majority of them are Syrians. And supposedly, they like their country. They don't like to be puppets to any foreigners. That's what we suppose. So we have the same basis. We all don't trust the Americans for decades, not because of the war, but they only say thing and they do the opposite. They tell daily lies. So we have one option, is to live with each other as Syrian, like forever. This is the first option. If not, we're going to resort to liberating by force, to liberating those areas by force. We don't have any other options, with American or without Americans. We don't have any other option. So this is our land, it's our right, and it's our duty to liberate it. And the American should leave somehow. They're going to leave. They came to Iraq with no legal basis, and look what happened to them. They have to learn the lesson. Iraq is no exception, and Syria is no exception. People will not accept foreigners in this region anymore.
With regards to retaking territories, it seems inexplicably, whenever you eliminate one threat, say, be it Ghouta, another threat seems to materialize, and this has happened repeatedly. Now we have the Israeli energy minister who is threatening that his country could, quote, liquidate you and your government. Are you afraid? Are you afraid, and how do you take that threat?
Since we were born, I'm talking about my generation, and most of the generations now in Syria, we lived under the threat of the Israeli aggression. This is something in our unconscious feeling. So to say that you're afraid while living with the same threat for decades, this is nonsense. Israeli has been assassinating, killing, occupying for decades now, for more than around seven decades in this region. But usually they do all this without threatening. Now, why do they threat in this way? This is panic. This is kind of hysterical feeling, because they are losing the dear ones. The dear ones, al-Nusra and ISIS. That's why Israel now is panicking recently, and we understand their feeling.
Well, Israel is now seemingly striking across Syria, airstrikes at will. They're boasting publicly on camera again and again that your defenses, they're powerless to stop them, that they can do in Syria whatever they want. Is that true? Is there anything you can do to stop Israel carrying out its airstrikes in Syria?
Yeah. Actually, the first target of the mercenaries in Syria was the air defense. Before attacking any other military base, it was the air defense. And you would be surprised at that time, why do they attack the air defense? The air defense will not deal with the peaceful demonstrators, as they say, or with the moderate forces, and it cannot deal with extremists anyway. It's another thing, it's to defend the country. This is the other proof that Israel was in direct link with those terrorists in Syria. So they attacked those bases and they destroyed big part of our air defenses. Now, in spite of that, our position, let's say our air defense is much stronger than before, thanks to the Russian support and the recent attacks by the Israeli and by the American and British and French proved that we are in a better situation. Now the only option, my answer to your question, is to improve our air defense. This is the only thing that we can do, and we are doing that.
Well, Israel says that its strikes are so far that they aren't targeted against you, the president or the government, that they're targeted at Iran. They're to keep Iran, which is your ally, weak in Syria. It's strange, but Iran being here, they are your allies, it's no secret, they have helped. But them being here now puts you at threat. Would you ever consider asking Iran to leave?
The most important fact regarding this issue, that we don't have Iranian troops. We never had. And you cannot hide it. And we were not ashamed to say that we have. Like we invited the Russians, we could have invited the Iranians. We have Iranian officers who work with the Syrian army as help. But they don't have troops. The starkest fact about their lives, about this issue, the Iranian issue, that the recent attack, a few weeks ago, they said that they attacked Iranian bases and camps, as they said allegedly. And actually, we had tens of Syrians, martyrs, and wounded soldiers, not a single Iranian. So how could they say that we have it? So it's a lie. We always say that we have Iranian officers, but they work with our army. We don't have troops.
Well, changing subject now with regard to chemical attacks. There are now regular alleged chemical attacks happening in Syria. Your government and your allies have said that you had nothing to do with this. Your allies have backed your claims, denying any responsibility, saying they have no knowledge of you carrying out these attacks. The question is, in whose interest is it to gas opposition to you?
That's the most part of the answer. In whose interest? That's the question. Is it in our interest? Why? And why no? Because the timing of this alleged strike was after the victory of the Syrian troops in Ghouta. Let alone the fact that we don't have chemical weapons anyway, and let the other fact that we're not going to use it against our people, because the battle in Syria was about winning the heart of the civilians. This is the main battle, and we won it. So how can you use chemical weapons against civilians that you want them to be supportive to you? This is the first. Second, if you want to use it, let's suppose that you have it and you want to use it. Do you use it after you finish the battle, or before, or during? It's not logical. Second, if you go to that area, it was very cramped area by armies, by factions, and by civilians. Whenever you use such armaments or weapons in that area, you're going to harm everyone, something that didn't happen. And if you go to that area and you ask the civilian, there was no chemical attack by anyone. Even the Western journalists who went there after the Ghouta was liberated, they said, we asked the people, they said, we didn't see any chemical attack. So it was a narrative, it was just pretext in order to attack Syria.
Well, it may have been a pretext, but we now have proof that, even mere rumors on Twitter, a few videos of confusing videos of showing allegedly the aftermath of an attack is enough to justify for the United States, its allies, launching cruise missiles at Syria. What if, conveniently, there's another attack, alleged attack? Could there be a lot more missiles aimed at Syria?
Of course it could, because when the United States trampled over the international law on daily basis, sometimes in different areas for different reasons, any country in the world could have such an attack. What the legal base of this attack, what the legal base of their aircraft with their alliance, the so-called anti-terrorist alliance, that support the terrorists actually, what the legal base of that alliance? Nothing. What the legal base of the attack in Yemen, in Afghanistan, on the border with Pakistan, etc.? There's no legal base. So as long as you don't have international law that could be obeyed by United States and its puppets in the West, there's no guarantee that it won't happen. That happened a few weeks ago, and that happened last year in April 2017. And that could happen anytime. Exactly, I agree with you.
But the response Trump promised was going to be extreme and severe, according to his words early on. The response that we saw, the strike that we saw after the latest alleged chemical attack, was, it seemed to be much more symbolic, much smaller in scope, and there was inexplicably, again, a delay when Trump promised the attack and when it came. Why was there a delay? Did it have something perhaps to do with the Russians?
It has two aspects, as we saw it. The first one, they told a story, they told a lie, and the public opinion around the world and in the West didn't buy their story. But they couldn't withdraw. So they had to do something, even on smaller scale. The second issue related to the Russian position that time, as you know, that the Russian announced publicly that they are going to destroy the bases that's going to be used to launch missiles. And our information, we don't have evidence, we only have information, and those informations are credible informations, that they were thinking about comprehensive attack all over Syria. And that's why the threat pushed the West to make it on much smaller scale.
Well, with regards to the United States' relation towards you, President Trump has called you, quote, Animal Assad. Do you have a nickname for the U.S. president?
Yeah. This is not my language, so I cannot use similar language. This is his language. It represents him. I think there's a very known principle that what you say is what you are. So he wanted to present what he is, and that normal. Anyway, it didn't move anything, and this kind of language shouldn't move anything for anyone. The only thing that moves you is what people that you trust, people who are level-headed, people who are thoughtful, people who are moral, ethical. That's what should move anything inside you, whether positive or negative. Somebody like Trump will move nothing for me.
Well, with regards to the United States presence here, and there's an interesting thing, you know, I came up with, thought up of a while ago. There are now in Syria forces from five nuclear powers directly engaged in military operations in Syria, be it boots on the ground or airstrikes. And some of those countries are on different sides. How Syrian is this civil war still?
The word civil war has been used widely since the beginning of the conflict in Syria, even by our friends and by our allies, by mistakes, without understanding the content of this meaning. Syrian civil war means there are sectarian lines based on either ethnicities or sects, or religion, or maybe political opinion or political currents, let's say. Something we don't have in Syria. In reality, in the area controlled by the government, which is now the majority of Syria, you have all these diversities. So the word civil war is not correct. What we have actually from the very beginning, mercenaries, Syrians, and foreigners being paid by the West in order to topple the government. This is the reality, the mere reality, the very stark reality. Everything else is just masks to cover the real intentions, talking about political differences, moderates, peaceful administration. We don't have civil war in Syria. If we had civil war for 7 years, we should have been divided by now. You cannot have one country, united society, if not geographically, because now of the United States puppets and the Turkish puppet. Without that, you should have it divided socially. Go by yourself, deal with different spectrum of the Syrian society, And you can answer that question in the same way I'm answering now.
But with regards to a potential escalation, okay, there are proxy forces from all these five nuclear powers, as well as their own forces engaged in Syria. But you, as the president, again, must have information. How close have we come during this civil war, during this war, to an escalation between these nuclear powers?
In reality, we were close to have direct conflict between the Russian forces and the American forces. And fortunately, it has been avoided, not by the wisdom of the American leadership, by the wisdom of the Russian leadership, because it's not in the interest of anyone in this world, and first of all, the Syrian, to have this conflict. We need the Russian support, but we need at the same time to avoid the American foolishness in order to be able to stabilize our country.
And just briefly, one last question. The closer we get to the end, is the danger of an escalation, in your estimation, is it decreasing, or is it, on the other hand, increasing?
As I said at the very beginning, the more we get closer to the end, the more they want to make it farther. What does it mean? The more stability you have, the more escalation we'll have. The more reconciliation you have in one area, the more killing and destruction and trying to capture more areas by the terrorists will have. That's why within the reconciliation, when we start the reconciliations in many areas, the other factions in the same area try to destroy it, because they have the orders from the outside not to go toward any reconciliation. Of course, these, you have the orders with a pocket of money. So what you say is correct, but the more escalations we have, the more determined we'll be to solve the problem, because you don't have any other choice. Either you have country or you don't have country.
Mr. President, thank you very much for your insights, and thank you very much for welcoming us here and giving us so much of your time.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The plans to further integrate EU member states together are clashing with the rising tide of anti-EU sentiment across the continent. The latest being Italy, where the Eurosceptics are now forming the new government. How will the Continental Union come out of this? Well, I sit down with Matteo Renzi, Italy's former prime minister, to talk about this.
A shocking Eurosceptic win in Italy is sending ripples through Berlin, Paris and Brussels, throwing doubt on EU plans for tighter integration. What will the bloc's answer be to the spread of anti-EU sentiment? How can popular discontent within the Union be soothed? And will it force through radical change in Europe?
Matteo Renzi, it's really great to have you on our program. It's been a long time we were trying to get you as a guest, so amazing that you're here. Lots to talk about. So Italy is about to become the first EU country having a populist government. First in EU. Like, there were attempts in other countries, but never happened. So the two parties that form the coalition, they're going to be in the government. They represent everything you oppose. What are your thoughts about it?
My view is that we need a very good relation between government and people, but this relation will be based and focused not on the slogan and easy promises, but on the results, concrete projects, great opportunities. In Italy, the election show a country divided, with a victory for two parties will create a new government. My view is now it's time to verify if the promise and the slogan of electoral campaign will be project, laws, realization in the life day by day. So I'm at the opposition, but I'm really curious. We will see if after a great electoral campaign with a great proposal for the citizen, those populists will be able to achieve every result.
When your party was offered to form a coalition with the Five Star Movement, you said it's absurd. And now they're forming the government, probably the next prime minister will be from the party too. Do you still think it's absurd, or maybe it was worth it forming a coalition with them? Maybe you could have done great things together.
I think there are a great difference between Five Star Movement and Democrat Party. And the people who voted for Five Star Movement represent an idea of development for Italy different respect to the people who vote for Democrat Party and vice versa. So if Five Star Movement and Democrat Party should be able to create a government together, nobody could understand in Italy, because we are the rival, we were the rivals during electoral campaign. I think after elections, who wins make a government, who lost make opposition. So the idea to create a government between two rivals, it's very strange. Now it's time for the Five Star Movement to create a government. Now it's time for the Democratic Party to make opposition. I hope and I believe as soon as possible, very, very soon, in my dreams, in my hopes, and also in my ideas, will come back the time for us to come back to the power, to come back to create a government.
So when you came in power in 2014, it was like this big breath of fresh air, because this young man comes after this long period of stagnation, and you said, I will demolish the establishment. Do you feel like you've actually were able to do
I
that?
Think this is normal in the life. In 2014, Italy had a GDP of minus 2%. Now the GDP is almost plus 2%. In 4 years, every year, we have 1 point of GDP positive. This is different respect to the past. I know other countries have a very best performance, better performance. But I know Italy in 2014 was a country really, really in troubles. Now is a new country with more energy in economy. When I start as prime, I start my service as prime minister in 2014 February. The number of employee jobs are 22 million in my country. Now is 23 million, 1 million more. So in this period, we increase number of job, level of GDP, capacity to attract foreign investments, tourism, culture, manufacturing, export. I'm really happy for the results of my country. I know when you became establishment, it's more difficult to maintain the fresh image, the fresh approach. But I know the role of a prime minister is not maintain good your image. The role of prime minister is save your country. So 4 years ago, my surveys are better, but the number of jobs in Italy are worse. I prefer to change direction of economy, to change the results of GDP, than save my personal image. For my personal image, I have time to come back, because
You're
try.
Young, you have time. So you...
I'm 43 years old.
Yes, you're very
I'm
young.
Not, I'm not... I hope I have time.
So why I mentioned you promising to demolish the establishment is that these people who are now in power are also coming to power on anti-establishment slogans. And when you look at their ideas on paper, they're very radical. So, and they don't have a majority in the parliament. So most probably the reforms that they're proposing will undergo checks in the parliament. So whatever you have, the outcome of these reforms is not going to be what they're proposing right now. Do you feel like you come to power with this anti-establishment sentiment, but then at the end, the system never really lets you change things completely.
This is a good question for a lot of reasons. The sentiment anti-politicians and anti-establishment was particularly supported in the last period from the social media campaign and from use of social, particularly dark, in my view. I'm a very great fan of social media. I was one of the first to use Facebook and Twitter and Instagram in my country. I know in the last period, in the last years, a lot of people, a lot of politicians used social media not for change the country, but for the change the citizens, the mind of citizens, stress the elements of criticism, of skepticism, of angry against the politician and establishment. It's normal, but I believe this is very dangerous. Why? Because if today the populists won the election thanks to this sentiment, anti-establishment, became establishment, they risk to have the same reaction and the same impact in the citizens. So I believe a very important try to be very honest and pragmatic. There is a project for Italy and for Europe, a platform, a program. Who is able to respect the promise made to election, made to the citizen during elections? This is the point. So the governor, the people who win the election, have a very great responsibility. Let me be very clear. For the populism, everything is easy until to arrive to government. For Marine Le Pen, it's easy in France to have the same slogans, the same polemics, the same message, if she wasn't able to win the election. Because tonight, today, tomorrow, the man called to solve the problem in France is not Marine Le Pen, is Emmanuel Macron. It's very easy for Alternative for Deutschland in Germany use expression against migrants, against establishment, against Angela Merkel, because every day, every night, every month is Angela Merkel, the woman who is able, who have to be able to solve the problem. In Italy, the situation now is different, because the man and the woman, who is able to change the things are the populists. And I believe for the populists, everything is easy until you win the, until they win the election.
I'm also very curious to see how long they're going to stay in power, because I remember you proposed a constitutional change. You wanted to streamline the chaotic Italian government system, 65 governments in 70 years. But Italians didn't have it, didn't want it. Why is that?
I lost a very important battle, and a lot of my friends told me, why? You risk your role, your job, your chair for a constitutional reform. Usually a prime minister lost the job for economy. In Italy, economy finally knows an important news, an important recovery. Why? You lost for constitutional reform. Because I think for Italy it's absolutely important to simplify the system. Let me be very clear. I love my country. I think my country is the most amazing country around the world. I really fall in love with the
ability of entrepreneurs in Italy, of artisan, of cultured men and women. So I'm really excited for when I think about my country. But at the same time, I know Italy is maybe one of the most complicated countries around the world in terms of organization. You know, 65 government in 71 years. Italy is a kingdom of beauty, of intelligence, of passion, of food, of love of wine. But in terms of political organization, we are not the number one around the world. We are terrible complicated. I tried to change. I lost my job. But I think this was a correct fight. This was a correct battle. You can lose some battles, but if we haven't the courage to try to change, you lost at the day one. So
you talk like Churchill. What can I say?
But Churchill is a totally different thing. But I think you have to try. You have to try. This is very important. But obviously, if you try, you can win and you can fail out. I think this battle for constitutional referendum was correct, but the citizens decide to vote no, and so now it's time for other people. We will come back.
We're going to take a short break right now. When we come back, we'll continue talking to Matteo Renzi, Italy's former prime minister. We'll talk more about Italy's future and the future of the European Union. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Matteo Renzi, Italy's former prime minister. Mr. Renzi, I just want to get all my questions in. I'll have one question about immigration, and I would love to talk to you about the future of European Union, because I know you're very outspoken about it. Notoriously anti-migrant Matteo Salvini will probably be interior minister. He's saying he's going to kick out 500,000 people out of the country. When you were prime minister, you were also very tough on immigration and illegal refugees and illegal immigration. Do you think that's the way to go?
It's very easy play with the fears of the people. And in the history, Italians were migrants. In the history of the United States of America, a lot of people come from America, from Italy. Apart, very brilliant and generous men and women who wrote the history of the United States. In part, criminals, killers, people from mafia. In the history of Europe in 1950, 1960, a lot of Italians leave the south of our country and went in Belgium, in France, in Germany. And a lot of people suffered for that. So we know what is the difficulties to be migrant. Italy is an incredible and gorgeous country in a very delicate position, because we are a natural bridge between Europe and Africa. And if the politics refuse to play a role in Libya, because this happened after the terrible decision of Sarkozy and Cameron to go in Libya.
And Hillary Clinton.
The United States of America, I remember Barack Obama in the Atlantic interview, decided to write an interview, make an interview, not write a book, about the mistakes of this decision, the decision of Europe and also of Italy. Because Italy, with President Berlusconi, decided to go to make war in Libya. And my view is that after this decision, we open a gate, not from Libya to Italy, but from Africa to Europe. This gate arrived for the lack of political governance in Africa, and particularly Libya, and for the lack of vision of European leaders. I remember the discussions with my colleagues in 2015 when I was prime minister. Please help, not Italy, please help these people who died in the sea. A woman who died in the sea, pregnant, a child who died in the sea. Okay, maybe I lost 2-3 points in the survey, in the elections. But I prefer saved human life than saved 2 points in the survey.
So what would you do right now?
Now!
I mean,
this not means I think everyone could arrive in Italy. I consider priority block the people in Africa and give them the opportunity to be able to create a new life in Africa, particularly because Africa.
But that's a long time perspective. What about now? People coming to your country, should they be sent back to the sea?
In the last period, a lot of the number of migrants are. Really significantly decreased. So now the situation is absolutely better than the past. But I believe all Europe is able to have a strategy, common strategy for migration. All Europe lost herself. For that reason, we proposed when I was prime minister, and I hope new government will confirm this approach, a very clear message. Now it's time to budget in European Union. And you know, the money is very important for European discussion. My proposal was that Italy gave every year a lot of money for all the countries, more or less 20 billion euros. And we received only 12, 13 billion euros every year. So the balance is 6, 7, 8 billion euros gave to the other countries in Europe. If the other countries, particularly the Eastern countries, who is the most important people who receive the money from Italy, decided to stop the welcome, more correctly, don't start with the welcome of migrants. Okay, we respect this decision, but please, Italy, stop with the money. Or there is a solidarity for everything, money, migrants, value. Or if there is the solidarity to bring the money and to refuse the migrants, this is not solidarity. This is an approach unacceptable. I hope the new government will continue with this strategy because this is the only strategy in the brief period to help Italy and Greece and other countries in the leading and the managing of migration crisis.
So this migration crisis, in my opinion, is probably one of the reasons why the Eurosceptic movement is so big in Europe. I grew up in France, okay? So back then, it would be unthinkable for Marine Le Pen's father to get platforms or TV channels to ever be second runner-up in a presidential campaign. UK is one example. You can be cynical and ironic about it, but I mean, it's an undeniable fact that these movements are gaining force. Do you feel like you, the pro-European forces, the traditional politicians in Europe, can gather together and strike back? Or are these forces here to stay forever now on the European landscape?
I agree with you. It's very different relation between France of today and France of yesterday. And the same is about Brexit referendum, if you think about suburbs of north of UK and the difference between London and Manchester or Liverpool suburbs. But I think Euroscepticism is very different. The number of migrants in France is unbelievable in respect to the number of migrants in Italy. It's not simply migrants the cause of Euroscepticism. In part, yes. And at the same time, I think in part is the lack of political vision of Europe. This is very, very important thing. Europe is an incredible experience of peace and prosperity. After centuries of war, after centuries of civil war between Italy, France, Germany, finally, Europe became the place of peace, of dialogue. But in the last period, we risk to reduce to Europe to only a technical approach, only a technician vision. I think Europe is a place of vision for the future, a global vision for the future. And in this way, I believe absolutely crucial to be able to give a message of change in the political leadership of Europe.
What change? Because everyone's talking about change, but nothing is changing.
Depends, because something is different.
You're talking about
for
Brussels.
Example, for the next generation, studies together. Erasmus is the best thing realized by European leaders, not parameters of Maastricht. The human values, human culture, human rights, civil rights is a part of identity of Europe. So if we continue to discuss only about parameters of Maastricht, fiscal compact, six pacts, and we are not able to give to the next generation a reason for the which to be proud, to be European. This is the reason of Euroscepticism. So we have a lot of single problems, single issues. Surely, migrants, surely the lack of employment. Youth unemployment is one of the most important problems of my country, but in general, a part of Europe. Surely, the lack of good relation between some cities and older cities, particularly in the banlieue, in the suburbs. Surely, this is true. This is a part of cause of skepticism, Euroscepticism.
But the economy and finance, no? Because it's not working for many countries to be streamlined in one formula.
It's correct also if you think about some countries very rich, you see the grow up of the skepticism. So Alternative for Deutschland in Germany with a very good performance in economy, it's a strange message. So it's not only economy, it's also economy. It's also economy, but it's not only economy. In my country, is not only a money's problem, because the rich Northeast vote for a populist party as Lega Nord. Please, this is a time for Europe to come back to great values, to great vision, to great ideals. And I believe, ideas and ideals, and I believe this is possible if the new generation of native European. Because I'm Italian, I'm Florentine, I'm Italian, but my passport is Italian and I'm so proud to be Italian, but I'm also proud to be European citizen. The next generation will be the generation who come back Europe to a side of value and not only to the side of government.
Matteo Renzi, thank you very much for this interview. All the best of luck with everything. Hopefully
thank you, so
you
much
come
to
back
you.
To the power and then give us interview again.
Absolutely. So.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.